episode 69, the sexiest of episodes. There is not going to be anything particularly sexy about this episode. I do apologize in advance for everyone who wants to get a little bit excited because of mine and Travis's faces. Travis will be joining us very shortly. I'm just jumping in a little bit ahead to give a little bit of a sneak peek, shall we say, of what to expect in this episode. So leading on from last week, where we talked about Top Gun, the classic 1986 pro-gay military promotional campaign video, I guess. We have gone on to another Tom Cruise movie directed by the brother of Tony Scott, Ridley Scott, legend. Obviously, Tom Cruise, directed by Ridley Scott. It's got Mia Sara from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, probably her most famous role, as well as the eternally brilliant Tim Curry playing Darkness. We're going to be talking about that a little bit. I have done my homework. I had some homework to watch some more Midnight Gospel. I have watched two episodes of Midnight Gospel and not had much actually else really to watch. I've been smashing my way through campaign one of Critical Role, campaign one again for I think the sixth time at this point. But honestly, I've kind of got to a point where there's not much that is really inspiring me. I have recently just got a new job. Hooray! I'm employed again. And I went camping on the weekend and had a lot of fun. Got introduced officially to Charlie the Unicorn on YouTube. And it was Shay's birthday last weekend. And me and our D&D crew, we played, well, most of them. Eric had to go home because he's got a baby and lots of responsibility. That's executive producer Eric Forrest. We played our version of Narrative Telephone, which the Critical Role team have done in their own way, and hilarity ensued. There may very well be some snippets of that coming up onto the YouTube channel later on. Don't forget, speaking of which, you can watch us live on facebook.com/JewishTerran, I believe, this time, 7 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. I guess that's what AEST stands for. I'm just spitballing here. You can also go to youtube.com and check out Fried Brain Productions. Just do a search for that. You'll be able to find us live. Make sure you subscribe there because it does help us get a little bit more visibility. And if you're a Twitch person, you can go to twitch.tv/thefriedbrain and you can watch us there live as well. And if you are on any of those other platforms, sadly not Facebook directly, but I do have the ability to drop into the chat. So if you have any questions, chuck them into the chat on Twitch or on YouTube. I do have Facebook up on the next screen. So if you see me looking off, it's usually looking at my phone for info or Facebook trying to chat with some people that might jump in. But please feel free to jump in and any questions you might have, I'll happily answer. I was this close to buying Overwatch on Switch because it is reduced at EB Games. It's like $35. But I still can't pull the trigger on that because I'm not great at first-person shooters just generally. And this one where it's team-based, I may have to give it a go on something like Xbox where it can still get it even cheaper than that. And just play there. I don't know. Like, that's the problem with Nintendo. They've got a good sale on at the moment. It goes through to the 14th of June. There's some really good deals in there for some very good quality games. But some of the games, unfortunately, the 2K stuff, like the trilogy of Bioshock and Borderlands, those are too new. They haven't been reduced at all. XCOM, I think I talked about it last week. That's come out as well. Really good games, but pricey. I mean, at least the two trilogy packs are $89 for three games, which is good. XCOM 2, it's $89 for the one. It's a lot of content, a lot of play. I'm really loving it, but it's a bit pricey. And there are some games in Nintendo's catalog that just never seem to get reduced. For example, Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze. Originally, it came out on the Wii U, And it's been out on Switch for a while. I'm talking like 2, maybe 3 years at this point, and it's still full price. It may have had like a 10% discount, something like that. But oh, geez, that's a tough one to buy into. I really want to play the game, but it's just so fucking expensive, and I know that I'm not that great at it, so I'm a little bit reticent to spend $90 on a game where I might just get an hour or 2 hours into it and go, this is too hard for me. I know, big cry baby. Sue me. Yeah, apart from that, not really much else. I don't think it's going to be a particularly long episode this week. Travis is having some computer chugging issues. I'm just going to quickly chat with him and see what's going on. So feel free to check out Plastic Man, my personal favorite DC Comics superhero, and anyone from DC Comics, if you are listening or watching, please reach out to me at the Fry Brain on Twitter. I have a really fucking cool story for Plastic Man. Really fucking cool. And of course, my favorite film of all time, that is Castle in the Sky, also known as Laputa, Studio Ghibli, Hayao Miyazaki. It is my first memory. It is my favorite movie even to this day. Yeah, check them out. Check out Critical Role merch and D&D stuff there. You can see my brain splattered on the walls. Okay. Right. Oh, Travis is here and he is on. Welcome to the airwaves, Mr. Travis Croft. How are you, my good man?
I am fine and dandy. You started without me.
What's that?
Started without me.
I did. I gave a little bit of a ease in, just teasing ladies and gentlemen about what they can be experiencing this time. Obviously, our legend stuff, and just telling them where to go so that they can follow us.
You're telling our audience where to go?
Yeah, straight to hell, motherfuckers. No, not really. You're all lovely.
Those of us who choose to find it financially, which is none of you, so fuck you all.
How are you, my good man? This, of course, is Mr. Travis Croft.
I am fine and dandy. My apocalypse is going as well as can be expected. I actually went into the office for the first time in about 6 weeks last week. It was weird.
Yeah, I can
Get up
imagine it.
early and like leave the house. I mean, Jesus, lose a war? Like, I mean, fuck. You have to be around other people.
Yeah.
You have to be seen to be doing work. I just can't like go, I'm bored, I'm gonna play Overwatch for an hour and pretend I'm in the meeting. Like, I mean,
Yeah.
seriously.
See, I was just talking about I was this close to buying a copy of Overwatch on Switch because it is half price at the moment. It's $35 with a 3 months subscription to the Nintendo Online Service. And I just
Are
can't.
you normally a subscriber to that?
Huh?
Are you normally a subscriber to Nintendo Online?
Yeah. So it stacks onto what I already get because I get it every on the yearly basis thing. But I just can't. I just can't bring myself to do it. I don't know how much of it I would play, and I've still in the early days of XCOM 2, so that is quite a time sink.
Yeah, look, it's I don't know how Nintendo are. If you don't like it, can you return it?
Well, you can. I could return it to EB Games because that's where it's cheapest. But I. Actually, I don't know if I could because it's a download only code. You can get a box for it, but you have to download it. So you probably can't return it.
So in that case, then there's a little bit of a risk because you don't know if you're going to like it.
Yeah. So.
I've told you it's good, but then again, we don't always enjoy the same games.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see it with me. Like everyone lost their shit over The Last of Us, and I was like, "Oh, BioShock," and you're like, "Yeah,
Yeah.
all right, I guess."
Yeah, I'm
With
thinking
this
I
much
might get it
hype,
for like
yeah,
X.
possibly live up.
Yeah.
But yes, I was going to say also the part of it is that it is a lot more fun to play with people you know,
Yeah.
and the very, very rare occasions I've got to do that, it's super fun. as opposed to playing with randos. With Sony doesn't do crossplay, I'm dead certain Nintendo don't.
Nintendo have actually been pretty good about crossplay. There was this whole ad campaign about sort of like, particularly with Minecraft, I think it was, where it's like Microsoft logo one side, heart, and Nintendo on the other side, because they were the only ones that were happy to have that crossplay.
What do you want, guest
host? Wow, Mel, you are on time. Very good. What time is it in Canada, eh?
Oh, Canada, eh?
I have my friend Mel from Canada.
Hello, Mel.
Mel is, where are you living now, Mel? I think you're living in Vancouver or Vancouver Island, if I'm not mistaken. I could be a few moves. Husband in the Navy. Husband used to drive submarines, I think, which is insanely cool. I next time I see Dom, I'm going to have a conversation about Das Boot, because what a great film that is. And I'd be very disappointed if life on a submarine isn't exactly the same as Das Boot. Shot 40 years ago, about a war 80 years ago, but surely submarines can't change that much, can they? Victoria on Vancouver Island. Yes, I've not been to Victoria. I have been to Vancouver once a very long time ago. And, I saw someone today just sort of making some jokes about the fact that, you know, Canada might resist invasion from the United States if, you know, four Mounties and a flying raccoon. as I said to the person who pointed that out, I was like, do not discount the power of Nickelback. You know, like, Canada's been holding him back for this long, you know. If Justin Trudeau said, boys, do your worst, the world would be a much worse place right now.
Ooh, weaponized Nickelback.
Head the podcast later on Spotify or other places you can.
Yes, I have been very lax, and the last two haven't gone up on podcast things. I am actually in the process of doing it now, so I do apologize, everyone, but it will be back. It will be back. Lost Travis. He's having computer issues once, as I mentioned before. But we spieled enough. I'm going to wait for him to come back. I had to go and get Archimedes. He apparently desperately needed to be part of the show. But hello, Louise, and hello, Can. Thank you for liking on Facebook. Do appreciate it. We could just sit here in awkward silence. That would be an interesting show, I guess. Just me sort of like a But I don't think people would actually find that particularly interesting. I'm just vamping now. Not much else to talk about. Hello, my boy. Hello. What? Hang on. There he is. My boy. Such a good doggy. What? You can't have my steak. You can't. I'm sorry. There he is. Look at that face. See, people would just happily watch this for hours, I think. So we're having troubles with Travis, and still not back yet, but hopefully we'll get him back. I am actually going to talk a little bit about... go away. Go on, you scavenge. Society in Australia is slowly but surely reawakening. We've still got like social distancing and recommendations of working from home until July, I think it is. But things are slowly but surely starting to come back into the norm. And eventually, I'm hoping that soon we'll be able to get to actually going to cinema. Like, I was looking into it now, and cinemas are kind of advertising that they're going to be doing social distancing with, like, two seats between each person, that sort of stuff. But then it does beg the question that Travis and I have been talking about for a while. What do they put on? I mean, Travis went to go and see the classics. He saw Grease Sing Along last week, as we all know, thankfully, finally, after 4 years. But... you know, the mainstream cinemas, what are they going to do? Are they going to have to go kind of like old school classics for a while? Because even Tenet Chris Nolan's new movie coming out. That was like the next big tentpole movie to come out, and that has been pushed back. I don't think it's been pushed back far, but it certainly has been pushed back. There are still some persistent rumors that Bill and Ted Face the Music, which new teaser trailer dropped earlier today or yesterday evening, some, around that time, that may go to digital. It's going to be an interesting few months as the world kind of reawakens, because obviously there are certain movies that have been kind of indefinitely delayed or heavily delayed, like Bond was supposed to be a summer thing, and now it's definitely going to be in kind of November time. But, you know, if cinemas aren't going to be able to showcase new content until November, or the big blockbuster movies until November, it's going to be a kind of a scary time, I think. I'm just going to try and send, cancel that. Might still need to send Travis a new connection code, because we are doing this via Restream, which is working really well, actually. You know, getting us live on three different platforms all at once. And I don't have to use OBS, which is definitely handy. You are all witnessing. Oh, he's back. And he's back. Welcome back. I've just been vamping for the last few minutes.
Sorry, it just completely just dropped out and then it wouldn't reconnect.
That's okay. I was just talking about, you know, I've been looking into cinemas, and obviously the drive-thrus are back up from last week with Grease.
Drive-ins.
Yeah. Drive-through cinemas. It's a whole different thing.
Not that old penny, Nickelodeon, where, you know, you'd crank it, you'd see a woman, like, lifting her skirt for 30 seconds or whatever.
No, it's just talking because Tenet, Chris Nolan's next movie, has been delayed. Not heavily, I don't think, but it has been delayed. And it's like, do you think cinemas are going to reopen, regular cinemas are going to be reopening with the social distancing rules, doing kind of classics, old school movies?
No. I don't think your multiplexes are. I don't know if there's a market for it with multiplexes. But I can say, and Melanie says Brian Adams is a racist slog. Okay, I'm going to have to ask about that later.
He got in trouble recently, I think, on Twitter for something he said.
But everyone, that's all the cool kids are doing that. I can speak from experience. We might as well just leap into it, considering the technology is not playing nicely with us tonight.
Yeah.
Because I did go to the drive-in last Friday night, and I did finally fulfill a long-held promise to see the sing-along version of Grease.
Mm-hmm.
And it was chockers.
Really?
Full.
Wow.
Not a spare space to see Grease.
Okay.
In fairness, it's not the biggest drive-in I've ever been to. If you're here in Melbourne, we have three drive-ins. Coburg is probably the biggest, the one out near Pentridge. But it's still a good size, and there are a lot of cars there. And there was, I think, the Jumanji film from earlier in the year, and
Sonic
the Hedgehog, and Vin Diesel film, Bloodshot, Bloodspot.
Oh yeah,
that's about as new releasey as it got.
Yeah.
And they also had the Blues Brothers showing there as well this week. So it's a lot of classic stuff showing, classic old favourites showing at the Lunar Drive-In in Dandenong, who aren't my sponsor. Mm. I'm just a fan of their work. But yes, I did finally see Grease. Some people were curious. I was getting numerous messages from people during the during and after. What do you think of it? You've seen it, right?
Yes.
I don't know. And I have Mel on my stream here. I don't know who the other person is, but what is the obsession with this film? I reviewed Dirty Dancing a few years ago. Is it, if you went 11 and had a womb when you saw it for the first time, you know, I just don't think you're going to get that film. If you went, again, I'll take that for womb part away from this and go, if you went 11 or younger when you saw this, I'm not sure it would be held in such high regard. It's not good. The songs, there are some catchy songs, and we all know what they are because they've been big hits, even separate from the film. there are probably three really good songs in the film. The rest of them are completely forgettable. What else? So much to say. I turned to Caroline, my independent observer. Well, I guess there might be both a question of independence, but she was my independent observer in the evening, who did validate my appearance at the film, and that I didn't just turn the radio off and listen to Slayer. she was doing the dance moves. I turned to her after about 20 minutes and said, is this supposed to be a satire? Like, is it supposed to be 1978 making fun of 1950, whatever it is? Like, is it supposed to be tongue-in-cheek? Or is it supposed, like, you know, is it supposed to be wacky? I don't know. Is it just me? Or are you still there?
I was just playing with spotlight on and off. You're talking, so I'm spotlighting.
So, yeah, we've had a bad experience already tonight. So, I was confused. Like, is it supposed to be wacky and zany, or is it supposed to be a satire? After a while, I kind of landed on this isn't smart enough to be a satire. It's just dumb enough to not be. The other part of it that surprised me was the politics of the film. This is a deeply problematic film. And Melanie, if you're still watching on my stream, if you haven't seen the film lately, do watch it again. Like, the sexual politics is really questionable. Like, so if this is a film I showed to children.
this is actually an interesting topic right now because, you know, movie, like I've seen in the last 2 days, like the British comedy show Little Britain has been removed off of all streaming services because of depiction of blackface, as well as men dressing up as women and sort of like inappropriate things. And the creators of the show have even gone through and said, yeah, we wouldn't make that now. And we do kind of regret making it even then, as well as Gone with the Wind has been removed until it has been assessed for its social commentary. So,
well, there's a story in The Guardian today from a guy writing about the Blues Brothers and accusing it of cultural appropriation. And it doesn't hold up politically, you know, white guys culturally appropriating the blues and, you know, the scene with John Lee Hooker playing boom, boom, boom in the market in Chicago to a black audience only is problematic. And I mean, you fucking woke millennial journalists should just, no, do not get started on the Blues Brothers. I don't know. I think I had problems with that article. You're right. It's certainly topical. We in Australia have a grand tradition of showing children things that weren't made for children. Mel, you maybe won't remember. The Grease, I was talking about Dirty Dancing and Grease actually, yes, both have sexual politics are quite problematic. But Grease in particular, because I saw Dirty Dancing a couple of years ago, but Grease this week, and I found the sexual politics troubling in the sense that there's a line in the Grease Lightning song where he says it's a real pussy wagon. And I'm like, I guess maybe that would go over a kid's head, but like, really? You know, there's the, you know, Wella Wella, did she put up a fight?
Yeah.
Very far, you know, and this is, like I was going to say, like when we were kids, there was the British TV show, The Goodies, which I do not believe was made in any way, shape or form for children. But it was shown on children's television here.
Yeah.
It remains for many years a favorite for people who grew up with it like me. And now Grease, and then there's a scene where there's a guy in the bleachers upskirting a girl flying down the bleachers, looking up her skirt. I'm like, I guess upskirting wasn't a thing back then. But and then there's the scene at the end with the TV host for the Bandstand show, basically cracking onto high school girls. I'm like, whoa, that's fucking creepy. Like, I just kept saying to Caroline quite regularly through the film, this is kind of creepy. That's kind of creepy. What he's doing now is creepy, and like. John Travolta's character is fucking creepy.
John Travolta.
Well, I mean, the fact that it's John Travolta does make it creepy. Like, you know, half the time I kind of forgot about that and just were trying to think of him as Vincent Vega, you know, quite a way.
Vincent Vega, the early years.
Yeah, yeah, you know, maybe that would have been quite funny to see him shoot somebody, but, you know. But also Carrie, right?
Yeah,
because that was a fairly similarish role a few years earlier, where he played the high school dance and that kind of thing. So yeah, the sexual politics of a film were really problematic. It was like, oh, this is creepy. Why do people show this to children? Have they watched it first?
So do you think that this movie should be kind of removed from general population circulation?
Yes.
Okay.
No, that's just because I don't like it. I don't really. I'm not in favor of censorship, so I don't think a film, as a rule, a film like Gone with the Wind, if you find that problem, I think this is a problem with woke cancel culture. If you watch a film like Gone with the Wind, which is, what, the 1930s? So it's almost 90 years old or something now, like 80, 90 years old, trying to place your overlay, you know, a 2020 mindset on a film made in the 30s, I think is foolish. I would say the same of something like The Blues Brothers. I don't think it's as problematic as some of the others are. Mm. But, like, again, that's a 40-year-old movie now.
Mm.
You go, from a 2020 perspective, some of the things in it, you know, aren't quite as cool as they used to be, I think is dangerous and foolish and inevitably an empty gesture.
Mm.
That's my opinion, obviously. Like, if you're somebody who felt, you know, like if there was a homosexual character, I don't think there are any homosexual characters in either of those films, but I guess if you're a person of color, you could definitely have something to say about both of them. But I guess in my opinion, I think you have to remember when the film was made and the world it was made in and the intention of the filmmakers and these type of things when you're thinking of it. And, you know, I think, though, Grease should only be removed for being ultimately incredibly dull and stupid. It was fucking long. Like, it was long. Yeah, I mean, just one of the quick, while I'm talking politics, so Mel's just telling, and this is, Mel's had an interesting observation here. She was troubled by the age discrepancy of the characters. And the botched abortion is something, that's from Dirty Dancing, the abortion angle. But yeah, like all the actors in who are trying to play teenagers in Greece look like they're about 37. Like, none of them look like teenagers. The one thing I did notice about this film is I think Rydell High might be the whitest school that ever existed in the United States. Like, this is like some fucking apartheid level whiteness going on.
Yeah.
Like, there are no people of color. I think there's an African American in the band at the bandstand scene. Someone said there were some athletes who might have been African American, but I didn't notice them.
Yeah.
But again, that would be problematic, right? The only African American people in the movie are musicians and athletes. so, I mean, that's just me, and you know, because I was bored and thinking. I guess if you like this film. One interesting thing to note is I noticed, because I'm familiar with some of the songs, is the audio mix is very different with the sing-along version.
Okay.
So some of your vocals and audio is turned down.
Okay.
So I guess that's the idea, is you have the graphic with the sing-along on the screen.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some bits where obviously, like I said, when I was 14, the Grease Megamix was number one on the charts for about 400 weeks. And so I am familiar with some parts of songs, and there are parts of the songs where the actual vocals have been having turned, parts of the backing vocals in particular are significantly quieter, I guess, in an effort to help people, you know, sing along if they want to.
Yeah.
So yes, I did it. It's done. It won't happen again. I won't make that bet again. I won't make a bet relying on fucking Rotten Tomatoes again. I can tell you right now. But, yes, I did it. I came, I saw, I watched Grease. I didn't like it very much, but at the same time, look, to be frank, Carolyn did ask me, my independent observer asked me on the way out, what did you think? And I said, I've seen worse. And she said to me, that's not much of an endorsement. And I'm like, no, no, it is not much of an endorsement. But then again, it also says something about how some of the shit that we've had to watch for this program, for you, the listener, we watch it so you don't have to. You know, the cinematic version of Jackass is what we're here to do. You know, with the cinematic version of being put in a porta potty and turned upside down. That's what it was when George had to watch Epic Movie.
Yep. And Grease too.
So it's done, but the drive-in, very, very, very popular right now. But people, I can only imagine Coburg and Dramana, maybe they have a drive-ins here in Melbourne and having the same experience of showing classic films. It's one of a few things you can do right now. Like, still, you can go out for dinner a little bit, but you can't go out to the movies proper, not a lot. A couple of the art house places are opening soon.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can take the kids and do something. You can do that at the drive-in.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, it's going to be an interesting scenario with cinemas open because, you know, how many cinemas are going to be able to survive all the way through till October, November, when things like Bond, Wonder Woman, and those big movies are due to come out? Are we going to suddenly see a massive surge of movies that would previously have just gone direct to video kind of thing?
Well, that was the question we talked about a while ago. But stuff's sitting on shelves right now, surely, but they had absolutely no intention of releasing into multiplexes.
Yeah.
That they're so desperate for product now. I can't imagine. And the thing is that you can't bring forward that AA grade product, Bond, Wonder Woman, because you can't release it in Australia.
No.
And then release it in the States 3 months from now.
Yeah.
Because it'll get pirated to fuck, you know. So, you know, you're not going to bring an A product forward, but you might bring forward some of that D grade shit. The New Mutants been sitting on the shelf for 3 years, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe you're prepared to throw that at the screen in Australia so it gets some business. Woody Allen had the number one film at the box office in the world recently, despite the fact he's being cancelled right now.
Yeah.
Because he got released in like four places in South Korea or something. you know, that's the kind of thing that could happen. Like, no one wanted to release that thing until Corona. So, that's a whole other story of a Woody Allen film. But, you know, I'm not going there. I don't know enough about it, but I'm going to say that he's not popular right now with a lot of people, including the stars of that movie. But yeah, I think it's going to be, it's just not true of the cinemas. The other part of the puzzle here in here and many places is live music and theatre.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many of their venues, I was just reading a story in The Guardian today about how much of the English theatre and live music scene will survive, which sounded very familiar to what's going on here in Victoria in the sense that they're not getting any government support in the UK as they aren't here.
Well, I mean, even thinking about like the big bands, because of like the streaming of like Apple Music and Spotify, it's kind of a well-known fact, I guess. It's a fact that artists get most of their money from their live gigs. That's where the bulk of their money comes from, unless there's like tracks are downloaded like 10 million times or YouTube music videos get 10 million views or something like that. So, you know, can you imagine going to the MCG to go and see the biggest band in the world right now and social distancing rules have to apply?
Weird. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah. You are right about that Spotify. I think Peter Frampton sued them a few years ago for Baby to Love Your Way. Had some ridiculous number of streams, and he got like $1,500 or something for it. And I'm not getting the numbers right, but that did happen. He did sue him.
Yeah.
There was a court case. Melanie's saying, I heard the release of Trolls World Tour broke the whole cinema going out experience. We are all in at home now forever for movie night. We talked about this a few weeks ago. Trolls did make a lot of money, maybe 100 million. I heard it grossed in video on demand. And we were, I think where we kind of landed on that was a kind of a moment in time thing, in the sense that was the hardcore lockdown period for, you know, late March through to sort of, you know, early May.
Yeah,
where things were hardcore lockdown in the West, at least, you know, here in the US, UK, I imagine Canada, where people were stuck at home with their kids and they just wanted to get them to shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And put anything on the screen to make them be quiet. Now, you have kids, you probably know what I'm talking about. I don't know if they would be amused by Trolls, but I think a lot of parents, like, this is first run shit and there's not a lot of first run shit around right now.
Yeah.
So This is like new stuff. They just put it on and paid the $20 or whatever it was here to rent it and put it on there on the screen.
Yeah.
We've talked about whether this is going to be a bigger trend moving forward. I think it for some films, I think we could have said, I think it may be tempting. So the Scooby-Doo movie came out the same way.
Yeah.
So maybe the kids stuff, I mean, for people, stuff like Tenet with like auteur directors by like Nolan, part of that was shot on IMAX.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Nolan shoots his shit on IMAX. You can't expect to get that. He would not accept that happening, people trying to experience his films at home. You can't.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't see Wonder Woman getting released at home. Like, even if Trolls getting 100 mil is kind of ridiculous, right? That's like a record for home video.
I feel like that was kind of an odd outlier considering the situation. And you just look at the subscriber numbers to Disney Plus, to Netflix, to Amazon Prime, to all of the fucking channels, because parents just wanted fucking content just readily available. And Disney is the number one brand in the world for kids to consume, whether it's animated TV shows or movies. That's so everyone's going to go, yeah, I'll have the 7-day trial and I don't care going forwards, because they can just watch all of the old school stuff. They can watch the new stuff. They can, you know, they're saying that the New Mutants might go on there. They're saying that the Mulan live action thing might go on there. It makes sense. And Trolls World Tour, it was never going to be the biggest movie in the world. Having it released at a time where kids can't go out, perfect. It's a perfect timing for that movie.
Yeah, and it made 100 mil. And you think about that, you go, yeah, that's all right. They probably get a fair. I mean, they're probably, again, they're thinking Apple, Google, they take a giant chunk of that the same way a theater would, probably even more than a theater would, because they've got a little bit more clout.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you think of something like Wonder Woman or, I don't know, James Bond, Wonder Woman would probably be looking, they'd be wanting. They'd be expecting a gross of around a bill. You know, I mean, Aquaman grossed a billion.
Yeah.
So you, for that film to be a success, it would need to gross $800 to $1.2 billion, you would think.
Easy.
So if you can think of how many streams it took, they sold, what, 100 million, a shit ton of streams for Trolls.
Yeah.
Would they sell that many? How many would you have to sell to get a billion to $1.2 billion for Wonder Woman? A lot. Like a shit ton at $25 a stream, which is more than what we would be paying to go to the cinema.
Yeah.
So I just don't know that those blockbusters are going to find their way. If you've got a low to mid budget blockbuster, Trolls animated, maybe it costs $50 to $80 million or something. I'm guessing,
maybe
pull the number out of my ass, but like it sure as hell didn't cost. It wasn't a $200 million tentpole film the way something like Wonder Woman or Black Widow would be for Marvel. I don't think we're going to see those films anytime soon on the streaming services. I'd like to hope so, because they'd be more accessible. But
there's
also people like me who would like to go see Tenet, the new Nolan film, at IMAX, so I can see it the way he intended.
Absolutely agree, yeah. Absolutely. There's certain movies that the big screen experience just heightens it even more, and Chris Nolan's movies are always designed with that presentation expectation. Jim Cameron's movies, he's always
about the edges.
Yeah. So, you know,
I'm going to free the next Avatar film's probably going to be 3D again. You know,
probably. We don't like that.
3D kind of died in the ass. So if you want the full Avatar experience when that comes out, you're probably going that way. But we should move on quickly, because I wanted to hear about what you thought about this week's film.
Legend. Yeah. Ridley Scott directed, Tom Cruise starring, Mia Sara, Tim Curry as Darkness, possibly the best makeup rendition of a devil put to screen currently. Oh, visually it's quite a treat, but everything else about it is, it does not
stand
the test of time. It is a movie. Had you watched this before?
I've never seen this film before. No.
Yeah. So before watching it, what was your where would you have kind of expected it to lie on a scale of 1 to 10?
I mean, Ridley Scott.
Yep.
So, you know, he's coming off Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
Coming off Alien before that. I would have thought 6+, 6, 7.
And now you've watched it. Where does it sit for you?
About a 3.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And just looking at the Metacritic score, it's on 30. 6.5 for the user rating. I think there's a lot more nostalgia driving that rather than people who might have watched it more recently.
I think I was saying to I was talking to someone tonight who grew up watching, who's a fan of his film, I think, from when they were young. I'm not sure if I did, but they were a fan nonetheless. And they said it's a film of its time. And I can see that because the films it reminded me of were films like The Dark Crystal, The Neverending Story. Films that, or a film, I think we watched it once with a podcast called Kroll.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it had Liam Neeson in it. You know, films that were in the made in the early 80s, fantasy, sci-fi kind of things had a feeling to them. And Mel says Legion is her all-time favorite, and Tim Curry is the film, really. You might want to block your ears because I don't think we're going to have anything nice to say about it apart from the fact that Tim Curry's great and the makeup's good. So I think I had that feeling of those sort of films. And I think I had Kroll on VCR when I was a kid because my dad had a camcorder and a VCR and he dubbed it from the video shop. And because owning your own films was pretty rare back in the early age, back when I was young, you had the tapes. You had about 5 tapes and you watched them endlessly because that was expensive to rent movies. So we watched Kroll over and over and over again. I quite liked it. But when you go back and watch it now, you're like, whoa, that thing's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
It makes absolutely no sense. So I think a long way of saying if I'd watched Legend when I was young, if I was, like, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, I probably would have loved it. If a young girl saw it, they would have fucking lost their shit about the unicorns.
Yeah.
And kind of cute Tom Cruise, young, cute.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But
the year before Top Gun as well.
Yeah. After Risky Business, though. So, yeah. A bit edgy about him, you know, a bit dangerous.
Yeah.
What you didn't have, like, I found this very, very difficult to watch.
It's, do you know if you watched the director's cut
version? I watched the version that was on Amazon Prime.
That's the one I watched. That is just the theatrical release. And I've seen the director's cut and it is better, but it's not much better. Ridley Scott is kind of the godfather of director's cuts. He did fantastic job on Alien, where he made the movie shorter but still added some bits in and it improved it. The final cut of Blade Runner, the director's cut of this is an improvement on the theatrical. Gladiator, fucking Kingdom of Heaven. Yes, thank you. They're all improved for the director's cut, but the difference between the theatrical and this is very minimal. And I feel like this was, as you said, a product of its time. And reading about the trivia of this movie and the kind of the genesis of it and the troubles they had with production, I can see why it's a mess. Because the author, the creator of the idea, the story of Legend, was kind of planning it as this grand epic book series. And there's so much more lore in there. And this is something that I've said so often, going to John Carter, going all over the map of lore being kind of thrust in and trying to tell this deep, rich, meaningful story instead of just going, you know what, we're going to start small and then explore these other outer edges of the story at a later date if we have a successful first go. And I feel like if someone sat down and had an interesting and spent time developing something, this could be a really fucking cool TV series world to live in and to experience, because the idea of darkness and the unicorns and the creatures of the forest and the fact that Mia Sara's character is a princess, but she just randomly roams around and steals shit from people's houses and stuff. There's a potentially interesting story there, but there's so much going on. And yet somehow this movie feels so slow.
It's really slow. I think it's not very, I think it's actually, you're right. I mean, maybe the writer had a bigger idea and have tried to cram too much in here. I just think it's deeply unoriginal. I mean, it kind of seriously reminded me of Narnia. You have a whole, you know, the evil doer sort of has the land locked in almost a constant winter. Except Narnia was much, much better done, at least the film, you know, the book, you know, I can hear that argument. But it was also just like, it feels really, really, really old and out of date. Like it, the unicorns, it felt like it was a parody. Like it was like, you almost expected it to be like a Seth MacFarlane parody or something of what an 80s fantasy film should look like. Maybe they could I didn't find the world or the setting interesting remotely at all. But then again, I put my hand up as I usually do in these situations and say, fantasy, not really my jam. Mm. So, I mean, if there was a TV show about unicorns and goblins and a princess, that would probably be right towards the bottom of my list of things to watch.
Because I think part of the problem as well for Legend is that in quite a few ways, like there's a rumor that Legend is the big inspiration behind Shigeru Miyamoto creating the Legend of Zelda series, which I get. When you look at it, there's a lot of similarities and there's a lot of tropes in this movie that do feel tired. But I feel like there might be a little bit of the Godfather syndrome here where it's like, okay, this has been done and done and done and done, and just revisiting it, it feels tired beyond its years because of the fact it essentially comes down to a battle of light versus dark, which is the quintessential protagonist-antagonist story arc.
It's not, we've seen it at much different places. Interesting to hear Mel's, from a fan, someone who grew up with this film.
Yeah.
I realize I'm not adding anything relevant to this conversation because my experience of Legend was that of a young fangirl, which is interestingly the mindset I was trying to put myself in when I was watching it, going, they must have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
The bright-eyed daydreamer who loved the deep melancholy of the girl, the brightness of the unicorns and the sets, and the overall daydream of the film, and the score by Tangerine Dream, who I think they took out the Jerry Goldsmith score and put in Tangerine Dream, which I kind of noticed a couple of times. It was kind of very synthy 80s.
Yeah.
Typical of, when you think of Vangelis' score for Blade Runner, it's not quite that iconic, but not a world away. Sort of a fantasy version of that.
No.
So that's exactly kind of what I was thinking while I was watching this, going, if I was a young girl in 1986 and I saw, and someone came home from the video store with this, and you would have gone, oh no, beta. No, you would have said, you probably would have found this and gone, wow, you know, this is exactly in your sweet spot, right? Unicorns, princesses, you know, the handsome, you know, roguish guy coming to the rescue.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was everything you would have wanted, but it felt insanely dated now to be watching it that way. Whether it's the Godfather effect of everyone's done that now and it's kind of done to death, or the fact it's just really slowly paced. Again, the person I was talking to tonight about it said that she felt that films today almost pre-digested. They would cut out the boring bits now because you don't want those boring bits in a film where you might have to think a little bit.
Yeah.
Filmmaker might try and make you think of it
successfully.
But it would also probably be based on a pre-existing franchise, but stretching the metaphor there.
Yeah, this would be that they would just do this. They would fight tooth and nail to get the Legend of Zelda franchise name. That's what it would be.
Yeah, I mean, and then there's been talk of that happening for a while.
Oh, for a long time. The big decider for it is going to be this Mario movie. It's being produced by the same studio that does like the Despicable Me and Minion stuff. They are apparently working very closely with Shigeru Miyamoto, the creator, to bring Mario to life as a animated 3D extravaganza. And, you know, it was Super Mario Brothers movie with John Leguizamo and Bob Hoskins that soured Nintendo so much that they have not given the license to anything Nintendo related in movies up until Wreck-It Ralph 2, I think. There's a brief cameo of some Nintendo characters there. And they are now trying, with new leadership, they're now trying to push in, like, apparently at the end of this year, probably start of next year at this point, Nintendo Land is going to be opening up in Japan, and they have got this Mario movie in development.
They've got mobile games now.
Yeah, they're now doing a bigger push. So, and there's still that persistent rumor that Netflix are going to have an animated Legend of Zelda series, which I'd be all for. That would be a fucking
awesome. It's good, though. It would be risky, though.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely risky. But I feel like we've entered a position now where the filmmakers and TV producers and those series creators are the people that grew up loving this shit, rather than back in the...
wasn't taken seriously.
Yeah, and whenever the Super Mario Brothers movie came out, the late 80s, early 90s, it was still, the franchise itself was new, but it was popular, so they expected money. And it wasn't someone making it who grew up on that. These are people who have grown up on those products for so long. Apparently they're going to start filming, they've got the writer for the Chernobyl series doing the pilot for the Last of Us TV show.
It's been my baby for a long time to say something from a video game, which will maybe be higher quality. The odd sexual energy that Tim Curry gives off in the Dark Devil costume. I'm not sure I picked that up. My first thought about Tim in the Dark Devil costume was how remarkably well. Now I know exactly where Tenacious D got the Dave Grohl costume when he Dave Grohl played the devil in both the tribute film clip and in The Pick of Destiny. I'm absolutely dead certain now it was influenced directly by Tim Curry's in that.
Surely.
How do you have Tim Curry, an incredible actor, in obviously the best part of the best aspect of a film, that he doesn't even appear on screen for an hour?
No. In the director's cut, he does have more screen time. But you know what I found really weird? You know the scene where Mia Sara's character has been corrupted and she's wearing the black and she's got the makeup and she's kind of saying, I would rather stand. And he's sort of like, sit! And being all kind of uppity. For me, I feel like there's moments where he's talking to her and sort of like, oh, do as you wish. And he's trying to be kind of
charming,
pseudo-sexual charming. Yeah. But the outrage outbursts and bizarre things, it just made me think of Rick Mail.
It's the thing, it's the anniversary of Rick's death today, I think.
Yeah.
I never watched a lot of Rick Mail.
I
was never a fan. So I remember if you come up in my Facebook memories today, but when he passed away, I never realized exactly how huge he was with so many people. Like, I never liked The Young Ones. I didn't like his films. I didn't like Bottom. I didn't like Rick Mail at all. So I guess that's kind of going over my head, not having the experience of Rick. Any one of his characters in particular it reminded me of? Yours, sorry?
Not really, just a lot of just elements of it. Like the outburst kind of reminded me a little bit of his time where he was Rick in The Young Ones, as well as being Rick in Bottom. And any time like Lord Flashheart in the Blackadder series, is elements of the movement that reminded me a little bit of Drop Dead Fred and stuff like that. So like, okay, it's Tim Curry, bizarrely obviously Tim Curry, in spite of the impressive super chin and the horns and the ears and the layers and layers of makeup that are put on him. It's very obviously Tim Curry, but just the mannerisms and the way he speaks, it just reminded me of Rick Mail for some reason.
Well, whatever it may be, it's like, yeah. I mean, and if you're Mel, if you're watching me, you might, this is like, I got big incel energy from watching The Dark Devil. Like, he is the original filmic nice guy, you know, like, I was nice to you, you should sleep with me. And then, oh, fuck you, you're ugly, you're a whore, when she says she won't slip down. Like, it's like, he's the ultimate nice guy, big incel energy. But he's one, despite that, he's very good. And I found it quite remarkable how wasted in the cut that I saw, such a wonderful performance was, it was actually Academy Award nominated for its makeup work. There's a number of, you probably read the trivia about it, how it took him, you know, so many hours to get the makeup on and off every day.
And then one time he ripped it, he got frustrated and a little claustrophobic, he ripped it all off and it ripped off his skin.
Yeah, that's to the art.
Yeah.
This was a trial. This was a chore. And I think Ridley is, he's got a hell of a lot more misses than he has hits.
His highs are really high and his lows are really low. And then the ones that don't qualify as those highs are very, very average. And I don't know whether it's kind of an indication of his personal investment in them or whether it's just they get released at the wrong time or what. It's really bizarre.
You know, you're looking at his work more recently. I mean, you know, he's Aliens, Aliens, The Force Awakens, and Prometheus. you know, it's been a long time since Ridley's done anything of note.
Well, I'm just looking down his listing here because it's been a long time. I mean, All the Money in the World I haven't watched yet, but, you know.
That's pretty good. That is pretty good considering what they did, the problems that they had with the production.
Yeah. Alien Covenant was not good. I'm not even going to say it was okay. It was not good in my opinion. It had some quality actors in it, but nothing of consequence is there. It's like a wasted film. You just put it there and it's like, okay, they did something with it, but it has not done anything of value. Much like this podcast, really.
Well, no, yes. I think I got free tickets to something once, so that was of value.
Mm. The Martian, it was all right. Exodus, Gods and Kings, not a great movie.
No.
The Counselor is not good. Prometheus is not good. Robin Hood had some interesting ideas, but it's not good. Body of Lies was okay. American Gangster was okay. A Good Year's not good. Kingdom of Heaven, the director's cut is okay. Matchstick Men, I have a soft spot for Matchstick Men. Obviously, it's got my personal heartthrob of Sam Rockwell. It's got Nicolas Cage being very Nicolas Cage. I kind of like it, but overall, the movie is not great. It's good. Black Hawk Down got a lot of praise. I didn't
really. We're going back away here. This is 20 years. I thought Black Hawk Down was okay, but it is 2001, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Hannibal was not good. Gladiator was good. G.I. Jane is not good. White Squall is not good. I haven't watched 1492. Thelma and Louise, I do not like that movie. Black Rain, meh. Someone to Watch Over Me, I don't know it. Legend, nope. Blade Runner, hell yeah. Alien, hell yeah. The Duelist, and that takes us all the way back to 1977. So
he misses a lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
But the more important question now, though, Travis, is where do we go from here?
I have a suggestion.
Okay.
And I'm going to go a little bit left field from we've gone directors, we've gone topics. I'm going to go writer.
Oh, okay.
So William Hjortsberg wrote Legend.
Yep.
He also wrote the novel, which the 1987 horror mystery thriller Angel Heart is based on.
I love this movie.
I have never seen Angel Heart.
Oh.
So it's got a 7.3 on IMDb. It's got a 61 on Metascore, starring Mickey Rourke and Robert De Niro and Lisa Bonet and Charlotte Rampling. So it looks like it could be good. And after the last couple of weeks for the last month of schlock that we've waded through, I feel like we deserve something that could actually be good. And you say it's all right.
When I watched this, I really enjoyed it because directed by Alan Parker. And this is generally, you know, it's 7.3, 61 Metascore. I really liked it, and particularly because I watched this as part of my kind of process and trying to get the theme and the style of Vaughn and my other books, kind of trying to get an idea of what that would be like. And I really enjoyed this. I have a feeling that it's not going to age well.
So it's been a while since you saw it?
It's probably been nigh on 10 years that I've seen it. It might even have been 11 years at this point.
Check it out. It's a very young, good-looking Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, this is before he decided to become a boxer. It's an interesting concept of, like, I mean, it says a private investigator is hired by a man who calls himself Louis Cypher to track down a singer named Johnny Favorite, but the investigation takes an unexpected and somber tone. That is putting it very lightly, and I'm not going to spoil it at all because I just want you to experience it. But there is a lot more going on here than initially meets the eye.
Sure. Well, that's kind of what I want. I'd like something a little bit more substantial than Michael Paré was able to deliver.
I will definitely say that the character that Robert De Niro plays is possibly in my top three for that style of character, and especially for Robert De Niro, because he is so quiet and reserved and minimalist in this. It's genuinely quite creepy.
I would like to set up the next 2 weeks if I can, because part of the reason why I wanted to do this is, well, one, it sounded interesting, and I'm sick of watching crap. And De Niro in it does open up our next move. So if you're watching, Mel and Tom are a person at the moment, so what we're doing each week is chaining our films. So we started with Streets of Fire with Michael Paré.
Yep.
We chained the Michael Paré film into the Philadelphia Experiment. Then we chained over to The Final Countdown because they're both about Navy ships traveling in time. Then we just moved over to Top Gun, considering it was a Navy recruitment film, as was The Final Countdown.
Yep.
Then we've moved from Top Gun to Legend, starring Tom Cruise. And now we're going to go with Peter Hjortsberg, or whatever the guy's name is, the writer of Legend, has also written Angel Heart. And when we have De Niro in Angel Heart, one thing that film I've actually been really keen to see, and after I saw Joker last year, is The King of Comedy, the Martin Scorsese film.
Ooh, yeah, that is a good excuse to go and watch that movie. Yeah.
So everyone says that you know, the Joker was very heavily influenced by that. I don't think you like Joker.
I really liked it. It was definitely an homage to Scorsese movies and to kind of period movies. There was not much true originality in it.
No, true.
But it was a very solid movie. Joaquin Phoenix does a fantastic job in it, and they deliver good in an excellent way.
It was it did evoke Taxi Driver a lot to me. but I haven't seen King of Comedy, so I'm curious to see that, because again,
this will be
a treat. So next week we will be talking about Angel Heart. The following week we'll be doing The King of Comedy. Mm-hmm. Planning people, it helps.
Mm-hmm.
should we move off Legend? I'm sorry if I've pissed you off, Mel, or anybody who enjoyed Legend, but it didn't do it for me. But what else has kept you busy this week?
Seriously, not much, because I went camping over the Queen Mum's birthday weekend, which was great. I haven't been able to go camping for a long time because of quarantine, for obvious reasons. It was freezing cold, and I was looking forward to last night, my first night in a house, in a warm bed. I thought, yay, I'm not going to be cold. I ended up being too hot because my body likes to be contrarian. But the thing that has really been consuming my life, as I said in the pre-show stuff, I'm still listening my way through campaign one of Critical Role. I desperately miss Dungeons and Dragons in my life. I particularly miss Critical Role because they are so good.
Is there no way to do it remotely?
You can. It's just, it's stressful. If you're the DM, it's kind of stressful when everyone is in separate sections, and especially when you have a group that are like cats on speed and planning just goes out the window. My anxiety just went way through the roof, and so I haven't done it myself. they have kind of, they like to be able to feed off of each other more organically next to each other and play scenes. So I can understand why they've done it. But there are certainly channels that you can do it on, like Zoom partnering with Roll20.net. Dungeons D&D Beyond is a fantastic online service for to use and utilize. But yeah, it's just way too much for me personally. That's just me. But not next week, because next week is my first week working my new job. Hooray!
Huzzah!
But the week after, I will be back face-to-face D&Ding with my murder group, which will be fun. I've got a few things planned for them. So if anyone hears or watches this between now and then, prepare yourselves.
And bring the tarps.
Yes. I will be reenacting scenes from American Psycho.
Mel was just saying she doesn't like... I recall you didn't like Joker. Mel really didn't like Joker.
Okay.
Did you actually see it, though? I remember your thoughts on other people's thoughts on it. Like, remember all the critics coming out going, oh, it's about angry men being angry men, incels, blah, which was completely wrong. But if you saw it and didn't like it, that's a different story. Well, I was a little busier this week. I promised in last week's show, I talked about last week, Mel's like trying to watch The Crow 25 years later. We've got to try and squeeze that in. I'm curious if The Crow holds up. The soundtrack does. Yeah, they're doing a remake of that, I think, again.
no, they're not. That's in perpetual development hell that is never going to see the light of day.
I'd take
money on that.
Okay. Sound of Music. Sound of Music sing-along session for him. If that film gets greenlit in the next 12 months.
You know what? I'm okay with that because it sticks to my rule of either profane musicals or it involves Nazis in some way.
True. But, the soundtrack, yeah. The trying to think of it. Golgotha Tenement Blues is such a great song on that soundtrack.
There are so many good songs on the Crow soundtrack.
Or Lost Souls by Nine Inch Nails is great. I remember the first time I saw Nine Inch Nails and they played that. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe they're playing this. It's so good. But we're not talking about The Crow. I promised or talked about on the show last week. Hmm. You said you've seen the 2018-19 reboot sequel thing of Halloween.
Yes.
And I talked about going back to see the original. And so I, for the very first time ever this long weekend, got around to watching the original 1978 John Carpenter masterpiece, Halloween.
And
I forgot this was directed by John Carpenter. Like, fuck. I think John Carpenter has to be probably in my top three all-time favorite filmmakers. I mean, the run he had in the 70s and 80s.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
So from this to... The Thing, to Escape from New York, to They Live. I mean, he was just knocking them out. Christine's in there somewhere, which is pretty good, as Stephen King conversions go.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was hot.
Yeah,
Big Trouble in Little China. I mean, Jesus Christ. The guy just couldn't miss in that period. I mean, he doesn't make films. It's been 10 years since he made anything, and I'm pretty sure the last thing he made was god-awful. But I guess he's just focusing on his music, which is fine because the music's incredible too.
Yeah.
You go from this music in this film is iconic. The music in The Thing, pretty damn near iconic. The music in Escape from New York, that synth thing he had going, iconic. The guy is a genius.
Yeah.
Flat-out genius. Now, this film, they made for $300,000. Nothing.
That's nothing.
And again, I mean... You wonder sometimes what comes first, the greatness, or does the film have greatness thrust upon it? Like, mm-hmm. So many times you read, oh, well, we chose to do this because we didn't have any money. And you go, that, what you just did there, the thing you did because you didn't have any money, is one of the things that makes this film great.
Yes.
Like, shooting it all in basically one or two locations because they had no money. It just was, it made it so much more tense. This is, they shot it with a couple of different masks. I talked about it last week. The mask, Michael's mask, is a painted white Captain Kirk mask. Again, they went to mask makers, like famous Hollywood mm-hmm. mask makers, and said, can you make us a mask? We can't afford to pay you, but we'll give you points in the film. And they said, fuck off. big mistake, considering his film was the most profitable independent film of all time for a long time.
Yeah.
It made a shit ton of money. So those guys would have made a shit ton, but they failed. So they didn't have money for a proper mask. So they improvised, and now the Michael Myers mask is iconic.
Yep.
So, you know, you wonder about that. But you have to imagine, everything else John did at the time was great. So he probably would have made it great no matter what. These instincts just seem to be on point about what is terrifying. And I guess, as with most great horror films, it's not, you know, I think when people make slasher films so often, they lose it. And they go, oh, I want to see lots of people getting stabbed and slashed up and, you know, guts and gore and, you know, kids being tortured and stuff like that, which is where maybe the Friday the 13th films go a bit over the top. But what makes this film truly terrifying is that it's not what you see, it's not what you don't see, it's what you imagine, what your mind's eye sees. And you don't see a great deal of Michael on screen. You know, when it is, it's fairly fleeting. He almost becomes this ethereal monster. There's one beautiful scene. I don't know if you've seen it recently. There's an incredible scene towards the end of the film where Jamie Lee Curtis is silhouetted by a dark door behind her, where slowly Michael's face just starts to appear in the darkness behind her.
Yeah.
And for me, the nerd, I'm sitting here going, oh, wow, man, how did they do that? How did they light that? That would have been, you know, when you read about it, you go, oh, that's basic. But, like, if you're a kid watching this, the drive-in in 1978, that would have scared the shit out of you. Yeah, and it is a little bit spine-tingling, that idea of, oh, my God, he's right fucking behind it. It's terrifying. Also, from a technical perspective, there's some great, very early version of a Steadicam shot, some great, you want to call it, what we would call Steadicam shots in there as well. Yeah. I think it's predates The Shining, which is also famous for sort of early use of Steadicam. But from a technical perspective, okay, I was nerding out about this film a little bit, but he just does it so well. Like, it's at the same time as being terrifying. It's also, if you go back to the politics of the film, I don't think it's particularly exploitative of its female characters, and that Jamie Lee Curtis comes across as pretty resourceful.
Yeah.
And pretty tough. Like, she's terrified.
Yeah.
But she doesn't, you know, she has some agency in the picture in the sense that she's, you know, she won't back down. I mean, she certainly very bravely acts to save the children from Michael and, you know, doesn't sort of sublimely accept her fate. And, well, she is saved by a man at the end of the day. She's, you know, I think she should be well remembered in the annals of females, not necessarily always running and screaming and from killers, though there is a part of that. Donald Pleasance was a wonderful surprise in this. I didn't know he was in this.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Christopher Lee was their first choice. And he turned it down because it wasn't enough money. And they paid him $25,000, and Christopher Lee is like, no, I won't. He's like, his agent turned it down because it wasn't enough money. Oh, and Christopher Lee apparently years later said it was one of my greatest regrets is that I didn't play that role because it's a wonderful part.
Yeah.
And I think he would have probably even done better than Donald Pleasance, but it was...
Donald Pleasance is fantastic in it, but he's... I feel like Donald Pleasance's character, there's a lot of baggage with him as well, that it's kind of hard. I find it hard to kind of... So like emotionally approve of him just generally because he's always very abrasive in any movie that he's ever in. And it's like, oh, okay. But that does kind of work for the character that he plays in this as well.
He was the president in Escape from New York, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yep.
Like, so that's where actually, it's probably the film I've seen him in the most.
Yeah.
And so it was such a weird thing because he's British and he plays the American president, but, and he's kind of a douche in that film too. So you kind of expect him to play a douche every time. But what a wonderful treat this was after having to sit through Legend, I have to say. But I enjoyed it immensely, and I will at some point, I'm tempted now to get over and watch, skip the sequels and go straight to the 2018 version that you talked about the other week. And
it's a really nice bookmark for Jamie Lee Curtis' character because she is absolutely not a damsel in distress in this in any way, shape, or form, except possibly you could argue mentally, but even then she's still fucking fighting. But going back to your early point, in 76, John Carpenter came out with Assault on Precinct 13. Then his next movie was Halloween in 78. Then he did the Elvis TV movie, which paired him up with Kurt Russell, which is one of the best cinematic partnerships of all time, in my opinion. Following that, there's The Fog in 80, 81, Escape from New York, 82, The Thing, 83, Christine, 84, Starman, and then his next movie was 86, which is Big Trouble in Little China, 87, Prince of Darkness, 88, They Live. What a run!
I mean, there aren't too many dogs in there, right? Like, that's a lot of great work. I mean, and he was, I think he was Oscar nominated for Starman, if I'm not mistaken. But
I believe so.
So he's an underrated director, like, considering he was always working, or I mean, generally, not always, but generally working independently at those sort of times. I think Starman might have been a studio picture, but most of those, They Live, the Big Trouble, Little China, these are independent films. And you look back on them today, the sort of Thing has essentially been remade slash rebooted slash sequeled. There's always talk that they're going to do a remake of Big Trouble in Little China, but Rock was going to be in it. Who knows if that'll ever happen? The guy was working with not much, right?
Mm.
Yeah, you look at a lot of big studio directors, like big name guys, Scorsese. We talked about Ridley Scott.
Yeah,
big reputation, done sweet fuck all, and he's had all the money he could possibly want available to him for a long time now.
Yeah.
So the fact that John Carpenter did so much with a lot less. Have you ever seen his original Dark Star? One of the main characters, I'm certain, is a beach ball.
Well, interestingly, Dark Star stars Dan O'Bannon, who went on, he is one of the key minds behind the Alien series.
It all connects together, right? That was a real treat for me. I enjoyed Halloween immensely. Somehow I've managed to miss it up until this point in time. But if you are looking for a creepy film and you haven't, like me, you haven't seen Halloween, I think the 78 version holds up as well as any horror film you might want to mention right now. You know, The Exorcist, it'd be up there with them. It's if you're looking for a genuinely creepy, scary movie, if you're just looking for some nubile campers to get killed while they're having sex, then you can stick with Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
The other one I caught up with this week, this one's an interesting one. This is a new animation from Justin Roiland of Rick and Morty.
Okay.
And that is called Solar Opposites. It doesn't involve Dan Harmon, I should note. So it kind of lacks some of the edge that Rick and Morty has. It's not quite as good as Rick and Morty, I would say. Well, Rick and Morty in its best is difficult to top. I think it's some of the best stuff that's going around.
Mm.
But Solar Opposites is pretty fucking good. Okay. It is really good. Season one is available. Nick is saying she hates horror films, but Halloween is brilliant. I think there are different definitions of what a horror film is. Some people said with, slash and lots of guts and gore and violence, and sometimes they're just genuinely terrifying and creepy thrillers, which is what Halloween is. But Solar Opposites, the first season dropped a few weeks ago in the States on Hulu. So Mel, I don't know if you can get Hulu in Canada. If you can, you might be able to enjoy Solar Opposites if you have it. It is not available in Australia at the moment.
Grr.
It does not have a broadcast partner in Australia. So I stole it because there are a multitude of ways to sell your product to me, and you have chosen not to sell it to me, so I will take it. I subscribe, as I say every week, I subscribe to 4 bloody streaming services. If one of those isn't good enough for you, then fuck off.
Yeah.
But when and if this gets an official, I'm sure it'll get a release somewhere in Australia at some point in time on one of the official services. I would give it a recommend. So the show itself surrounds a family of aliens who have moved to Middle America, where they debate whether life is better there or on their home planet, which I think is probably not a particularly good synopsis. We have the family of aliens who have evacuated their home planet when it was destroyed by a comet, mm-hmm. and a crash land on Earth and are basically trapped on Earth, and not particularly, and with varying degrees of happiness about that situation. So the head of the family, one might say, is Corvo, and Corvo is voiced by Justin Roiland himself.
Mm-hmm.
We have his partner, friend, husband, really clear, Terry, played by Thomas Middleditch, who those of you who are fans might remember he was in Silicon Valley.
Okay.
And he was in Zombieland Double Tap. He was the alternate of Jesse Eisenberg.
Oh, yeah, he was. Yeah.
So they're sort of – so Justin Roiland's Corvo is deeply unhappy about being Earth. He hates Earth, doesn't want to be there. He's sort of a contrast with Terry's character, who is into all things pop culture, you know, really adopting all things Earth. And they have – two kids, Yamulak and Jesse, mm-hmm. both voiced by actors I've never heard of, but both are really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
And they are attending high school, just to keep things interesting. And it's just kind of weird that everyone just accepts that there are aliens in the neighborhood and aliens going to the school without – they do acknowledge they are aliens, but they don't seem too fussed about that fact, which is – a strange angle on the show, and the fact that their house has a spaceship sticking out the top of it. This has sort of elements of Rick and Morty in there. So obviously it has a very high sci-fi element to a lot of it. So a lot of it plots are around, you know, them, you know, Corvo or somebody creating a high-tech gizmo to push the plot forward.
The animation style looks very much Rick and Morty as well.
It is very Rick and Morty. Some of the parts of the show remind me sometimes of Bob's Burgers, particularly the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesse, the daughter in particular, reminds me quite often of Tina, I think, from memory on Bob's Burgers. I don't think any of the characters, I think some of the people who are involved in the animation also worked on Bob's Burgers, so maybe that's what's triggering my memory. Or just the actress. Sounds like the actress who voices Tina. But it's not got the edge of Rick and Morty, like I said. And what is sometimes a little bit irritating, and I don't know if you find this when you watch animations, but the Justin Roiland doesn't do many voices, really. Like I watched a special of him on YouTube going over his favorite characters and they're sort of going through, you know, the characters he's voiced in various shows. I'm like, they all really either sound like Rick or they all really sound like Morty.
Yeah.
He's Morty. Like, he doesn't have a lot of range, and I think he would probably admit that. So, though I don't think his character, Corvo, actually sounds like Morty so much, he kind of sounds like a lot of the voices he did for the Intergalactic Cable interdimensional cable special. But you just sort of, if you close your eyes and listen to the voice, and if you watch a lot of Rick and Morty like I have, you'll just see his Rick and Morty characters in your head. So it's also like the guy who voices Bob in Bob's Burgers also voices Archer.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've watched a lot of Bob's Burgers, I've watched none of Archer. Whenever I watch Archer, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. That's Bob from Bob's Burgers. It's not a secret agent. He's a guy who makes hamburgers. and because he uses a very, very similar voice, so I struggle with that sometimes.
Yeah.
We don't really seem to have a unique voice here. So sometimes I think it suffers in comparison because you sort of hear that voice and you're thinking, Rick and Morty, Rick and Morty. It looks like Rick and Morty. A lot of the sci-fi plots are very Rick and Morty. You'd be like, it's not as edgy as that. It's more, you know, like I said, think Bob's Burgers, The Cleveland Show, you know, with a Family Guy in there as well. It's very profane. It is not for children, Mel, so if you do steal it, put the kids to bed first. This is the first American show I've ever seen that uses the C word.
Oh. Well, okay.
Once, but they used the C word. Mel likes Bob's Burgers as well. So, like, I mean, in Canada, I don't know if your C word's quite as bad in Canada as the C word is in Canada, by the way.
For anyone not sure, the C word we are referring to is conniption.
conniption, yeah. Or Caesar, your call. Or clans. So it's I'm enjoying it. It's an easy watch, if that makes sense, right? It's
okay.
In a way, like the really good Family Guy or Simpsons used to be, it's not quite as thought provoking as some of them. It's not quite as edgy where you're like, holy shit, was that a 9/11 joke? Mm. Oh fuck, they're gonna get in trouble for that.
Yeah.
Like Rick and Morty tend to do sometimes. It's just comfortable. They're, you know, 30-minute episodes. They're fluffy. They're easy to watch. They're enjoyable.
Yeah.
It's fun. I'm shocked it hasn't got a broadcaster. It's not on Netflix or any of the streaming services here, and one isn't confirmed to have it coming up.
Yeah.
It also was produced for Fox, who bumped it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I would imagine that might have had something to do with the Disney acquisition, perhaps. It's like, okay, this is a show that we are not going to be able to comfortably put on Disney Plus. And so
they take their TV or just their films?
They took everything, I think.
They didn't take their news division. Well, Fox News unfortunately still exists.
Yeah. But, you know, they've got, like, they've got The Simpsons.
That's right. They took The Simpsons, so they would have taken their TV animation, yeah.
And this is, if they're even just using one cunt, then that's not going to be on Disney Plus. That's just not.
Using every part of Hulu, they do. They own Hulu.
They own Hulu?
They do. Disney own Hulu.
Oh, for what don't they own?
But then again, I guess it doesn't have a Disney brand on it, right? Like it's yeah. You can, like, they own New Line as well, don't they? So yeah. they release shit without the Disney brand on it. It's okay to use a C word at least once.
There's that vague difference of, so like, oh, it's one of our affiliates, but we won't talk about that much.
But remember, we had this conversation. Why Disney started their own streaming service, right, when they own a streaming service?
Yeah, that's right. Of course,
A fairly big and successful streaming service.
Yeah.
That you could spin into your own thing, but no, we'll start Disney Plus, which is a competitor with Hulu. Don't get it. Anyway, but yeah, so if you can find it, like I said, steal it, because they don't want us to get it an easy way, so you get it the easy free way. It's well worth a look if you're looking for something to ignore.
Now, the one thing that I would like to talk about that I finally got around to, because I have got at least a temporary Stan membership, I have finally started watching Deadwood.
This is a Western, right?
This is the Western, yes, with Ian McShane, Timothy Olyphant, Stephen Dorff. Who are the other big actors in it? I'll just quickly pull that up now. It's got Molly Parker. And then there's a lot of people who's kind of cameo in it throughout as well. Oh my goodness, this is possibly one of my favorite shows already. I'm only 4 episodes into season 1 and I'm loving it. A show set in the late 1800s revolving around the characters of Deadwood, South Dakota, a town of deep corruption and crime. This has got this is a masterclass of character-based storytelling, and woo! It's one you have to invest time and energy mentally into.
Pretty dark, right? Pretty dark, pretty full on.
It's full on, and they will happily, like, Ian McShane's character of Al Swearengen has got some of the very best profanity put to screen, and just everything about it is brilliant. All the characters are so richly developed and so painstakingly delivered on screen. It is amazing. I've never particularly thought highly of Timothy Olyphant, but him as Seth Bullock in this show, they're like, wow, he's actually capable of really calculated character autopsy, and he every single movement, every mannerism, every pause in his conversations is so intensely thought out. It's really quite brilliant.
I think this is kind of one of those shows that Mel Stein has been very popular in North America for a while. I think it's kind of falls into the Firefly category, right? Because it was critically lauded. The people who loved it deeply and intensely. I think it got canned a little, quite early, right?
Well, it got three seasons, and then it got the wrap-up movie last year. I don't know, kind of, I feel like something like a show like this, because it was HBO, when it came out back in 2004 to 2006, we didn't have the streaming services that we do now. And you could only get it on HBO, or you might have been able to get it on Foxtel over here or Sky back in the UK. But those were expensive platforms, especially back then, and not everyone had them. I feel like if this had come out now, it would have been an astronomical success, because it has got that depth of character and kind of slow potboiler storytelling that the first two seasons of Game of Thrones were generally praised for, even if they didn't live up to it in the end. Those first two, three seasons of Game of Thrones, they had a lot of positive response to that style. This is that distilled. And having millions of people worldwide just consuming this show, I feel like it probably might have gone on even further. I'm curious to see where the end of season three leaves it, if it is that kind of cold hard, nope, we gave you three seasons, we're cutting the cord and letting you die, or if it was just like, nope, we wrapped up the story we wanted to tell, and then years later they thought, you know what, we've got a little bit more story in us, and do the movie, which I'll watch once I finish the three seasons. But wow.
It's I have friends who are obsessed with it back in the day. But it sounds like as you sort of say, you need an investment into it. This is not a dip in, dip out kind of show.
Yeah.
This is not a show you watch while you're playing around on your phone, like I was talking about. This is essentially what Solar Opposites is.
Yeah.
You need to be paying attention to what's going on, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 100%. Not really because of the intricacy of the story that they're telling, but it is definitely one that you need to pay attention to, considering the storytelling between the characters that is not vocalized. There's a lot. Like I say, this is a masterclass of character actor work. And when you see a scene run between, even right near the beginning, you have this hugely tense scene between Seth Gordon and covered in dust. You're always the last to know. I don't need.
Defense. This facade is beginning to show so many holes in these curtains. Why am I always the last to know? Make a decision, don't trip and fumble.